This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer squad. And with affordability top of mind for most Zoomers, I want to ask, are the new inflation numbers, which are being presented as good news for our budgets, are they really good news? The main factor driving the headline number lower to 1.8% from 2.3% in January, was the end of last year's tax holiday and inflation on food purchased from stores cooled to 4.1% in February from 4.8%. So are we celebrating that the price of beef has only climbed by 14% in the last year? And what about steep increases in the cost of gas that will certainly have a big impact on people's budgets? And in the midst of all this, a city councillor is suggesting we emulate one of the dumbest ideas I have heard in years, and that is city-run groceries. Now, we can't seem to clear snow, fix potholes, keep the pools open on the hottest days of the summer. So let's have the city and the city staff take on a really complicated business with very low margins that involves supply chains for tens of thousands of products. So what do you think? We'll also talk about a big nursing home fire in Mission, British Columbia that displaced 100 residents of a retirement home, lessons learned. So the texts and numbers, 866-744-740, that's the long distance phone line, local phone calls 416-360-0740.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'd like to welcome Anthony Quinn, president of CARP, David Valentin, a principal at Liaison Strategies, and Rob Davis, a former Toronto city councillor. And I ask, should we be singing Happy Birthday, Mr. Prime Minister? It's his birthday. He turned 61. He's getting a big gift from his poll numbers, which are in the stratosphere. And he's celebrating, or he doesn't have to celebrate, in one of his least favorite places to be, Canada.
He's lucky that he's...
It's not going on.
Well, let me say this. As a March birthday boy, I could think of no better place to celebrate than Canada. The Prime Minister's been on a tear around the world, and I guess he has an opportunity to go back to all of the places he's lived and all the times that he was outside of Canada for the previous 10 years or so. But the poll numbers are pretty remarkable, and I guess that's something for him to cheer about. And in part, it's because of the world situation in the Middle East and the economic challenges that we face with tariffs from the United States.
David.
Well, you know, he's got a 63% approval rating and the honeymoon is continuing. The numbers look great for him in Quebec, Ontario, the Atlantic, Alberta. Somehow he's tied with the Conservatives in Alberta this week. Really, things can't go very wrong for Mr. Carney at this point. He's going to have a great day, and I understand he's seeing the king. So, you know, I'm sure some good food will be served at the castle or wherever they're going to have that meeting. If he wants a birthday cake from Mark Carney, I'm sure the finest baker in all of the UK has been assembled to put that together.
It was my birthday yesterday, Libby, and I got a free scoop of ice cream at Baskin Robbins. So there you go. Ireland.
And we got your mic working.
Yeah, and that's the difference, I think, between what Mr. Carney has experienced in his 3 decades of a financial career and now in government, where he has lived certainly the high life, and he's in London, where he has a home, and he's spending his holiday in Rome. So, good for him.
Is it good for us, though? That's the question.
That's well, like David said, Canadians seem to be quite happy with what he's doing.
Okay, well, I want to talk about these inflation numbers and the way they're being presented to us as though, gee, this is great news. Now, first of all, the main drop altogether is with a blip because of the tax holiday. So, to me, that says it's not any kind of fundamental change. And okay, the price of beef isn't up 20%. It's only up 14%. Really, is that something that most people should be celebrating, Rob?
No, unless you're a vegetarian, it doesn't matter. Like, if you're a vegetarian, who cares what the price of beef is? But most of us aren't. And, you know, protein is sort of a main staple in most people's diets. And, I think that at the end of the day, the inflation numbers don't reflect the reality at the grocery store. And and seniors who have a limited income, often many of them, or don't see major jumps in their pensions on an annual basis, know that it's difficult to be able to afford to survive on the type of with the type of prices that we're starting to see in grocery stores, and right across the board, the cost of everything has gone up dramatically. So it's almost as if the inflation numbers themselves are belying the reality that people are feeling on Main Street.
Well, yeah, the only thing I take issue with what you said is it's good news if you're a vegetarian. I don't know if you've seen the price of fresh fruits and vegetables lately, but
well, that's a good point.
They're pretty darn expensive. I paid $6 for celery.
Yeah, I would have walked past that for sure. I was in Costco this weekend, Libby, and noticing the prices. And I went back to check the historical prices. So a bag of milk, and I buy the 4-liter bag of milk for my family, $4.75 in 2020.
Oh, that's 5 years great.
Ago. No, 5 years ago. Now it's $6.85.
Wait a minute. We buy the 2 liters from the grocery store, and it's about $6.75. So you have 2 liters free.
Well, that's buying in volume when you're on a budget with a big family. Cheese, we buy our kilogram of cheddar cheese from Costco. It used to be $11. Now it's $17 or $18. That's a 55% increase. And steak, I can't afford it these days, but it was $44 a kilogram at Costco. So it used to be $22 a kilogram. So it has, everything has doubled in price, Libby. So this report...
What kind of steak?
This is for the New York Strip. So okay. That's the... the better cuts of beef. So that 4.1 number is really BS. And for Stats Canada to report it, and for news departments to report that's the number, it really does lie to the consumer they know they're not experiencing that number in the grocery store. So I don't know why they continue to give
those numbers. And I don't know why they just read copy off this saying, this great news, it's great news for our budget. Really? Clearly written by someone who doesn't have to do the shopping. And often the cost of gasoline is eliminated from the overall inflation number, but there is no way that it's not going to have an impact. It's steep increases in prices at the pump. David?
Well, and I think, we're going to be entering a situation, given everything that's taking place overseas, where it's going to be really hard to understand what are the domestic factors that really are surging inflation and driving inflation upwards versus what are the international factors that are going to be pushing inflation up. And, already we're hearing about Trumpflation, the inflation specific to the conflict with Iran. That's going to make everything go up, whether it's gas, food prices a few months from now, as a result of the cost of fertilizer going up, et cetera, ad nauseum. But it's going to be really tough for Canadians with these kind of numbers being presented, understanding how much of this is factors within our control and how many of these are factors outside our control. And that's a really interesting conversation to have, because once you start saying everything is Trumpflation, everything is caused by Iran, then you're sort of in a situation where you can't do anything about it. You feel very helpless about it. But there are some concrete things we can continue to do to try to make sure that we're reining inflation in and bringing prices down. Right now, as we're talking about, like, a lot of people in the grocery aisle, myself included, we're not seeing that change happen yet. We're not seeing that positive movement yet.
Yeah, the other question that I have about the price of gas, I mean, we are, by the way, people, in the next segment after the Zoomer Squad, we're going to be talking about the Strait of Hormuz and what's going on there. It's a very complicated situation, and we have some people who will hopefully help us sort it out. I'm wondering, one of the bees in my bonnet, let's say, are the size of the vehicles that people drive, I think, completely. Like, what is with all these huge, huge vehicles that blind those of us who are
driving smallest vehicle available?
Driving a small sedan. And I have to say that even if the price of gas goes up a lot, doesn't bother me that much because I fill up a tank. It hasn't hit in this price increase. So before it's about $60, lasts about 3 weeks. So it's not really a huge deal.
Well, it's affecting the price of diesel, which is fueling the trucks that are delivering everything that we're using. And that will have an exponential effect on, or a down market effect on everything that we're spending our money on. You're always on the big trucks. People have different lifestyles and different needs, and I don't think we should worry about what other people choose to drive in a democratic and open country, but they'll have to pay the price. Maybe they'll be looking at electric now.
And to your point, though, what will happen is the price of gas rising will change people's consumption habits with respect to buying cars. So, yes, if gas prices remain at the levels that they are now, what you'll find is more people will be conscientious of the desire to perhaps save on their gas bill, and they'll look for, EV vehicles, or they'll look for hybrids, or they'll look for vehicles that are seemingly larger but have a smaller engine block. So they won't get the V8, they'll get the V6 version of the vehicle that they're purchasing, or even the V4 version of the vehicle that they're purchasing. So I think you'll see, downstream decisions, consumer decisions, will change as a result of a sustained level of higher gas prices.
I will just quickly say some of these large vehicles are actually electric as well, because they've got these gigantic batteries. I think there will be a lot of downstream impacts. Whether or not everyone's going to be driving a smaller car, I don't know about that.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of talk about we got all excited about EVs. Canadians, for a whole bunch of reasons, aren't wild about EVs, but this likely to be a good thing for them, David.
Absolutely. And of course, we're also going to be seeing those Chinese EVs showing up at some point, probably sooner rather than later. It doesn't sound like we're getting the most price-effective models coming in. I think they're starting off with some of the more luxurious ones rather than the budget ones. So if you're hoping to save on that, I think we have some more time to wait. But, of course, we're also looking to our domestic industry to start making some of these vehicles a lot faster and really finding ways to bring down the overall cost of the vehicle so they can sell it for less. I think at some point, maybe for people in urban centers, it might make a lot more sense if enough charging stations are put in and all these other infrastructure pieces that have to take place for them to have EVs. But I know for a lot of people, depending on their lifestyle and where they need to get to, an EV isn't really feasible just yet.
Well, I did notice that Tesla lowered the price of their entry-level rear-wheel drive already built vehicles to match the incentive, the new federal incentive for buying an EV. So they're down to $55,000, which is $15,000 lower than they used to be. So the market's coming down and interest will go up.
Again, just back to the whole way we look at these inflation numbers. I mean, I think it just makes people have less faith in these kinds of statistics that we get from the government, which are critical, actually.
CARP had a meeting with the representatives from the Bank of Canada not too long ago, just last month, and we talked to them about the consumer price index not being reflective of the experience, particularly of older adults, as was mentioned earlier. And we said that they are not buying electronics and gas barbecues and things that they weigh heavily in that large basket. So when it comes down to the cost of fuel and of heating their home, the price of rent and the price of groceries, that's where they're spending the majority of their money. And they are seeing substantial increases. So old age security increases and CPP indexing, they're not keeping up with the actual inflation that they're experiencing.
And into all of this, I mean, I'm laughing, but, you know, one of the most of us thought nuttier ideas to come out of Zoran Mamdani, the mayor of New York, were these city-run grocery stores. So instead of joining those of us laughing at it, a city councillor, Anthony Peruzza, says, hey, that should be Toronto's response to the affordability crisis. We should run some grocery stores. Rob?
You know, years ago, people will remember that council tried to legislate food carts so that, you know, instead of just hot dogs and burgers and sausages, people could try all of this wonderful ethnic fare. And so what they did is they formed, wait for it, a committee. And what the committee did is it started looking at regulating how that guy is going to sell Jamaican food or how that lady's going to sell Thai food and how that guy's going to sell Filipino food. And it became a disaster. And what I want to say is this. They couldn't run a food cart, let alone a grocery store. They drove those poor people who invested their money out of business because they wanted to overregulate everything that they did. And as God is my witness, if city council goes down this path, it will be an unmitigated disaster. The alternative is, of course, we kind of already do have government-run grocery stores. They're called food banks. And they're kind of run efficiently or more efficiently.
They're the private sector because they're not government.
Because they're not government. Because it's a not-for-profit that has ostensibly been contracted out to do this task. And so they do it with volunteers. Not unionized workers. They do it with a volunteer board of people with business experience. They reach out and they create an incentive, an emotional incentive for corporations to participate in helping those of us who might be less fortunate. But if the city runs it, it's going to be overpriced. It'll be the diktats of council saying, you can't have this Israeli product in the grocery store, or you can't have this Palestinian product in the grocery store, or this week we're angry at Donald Trump, so there's not going to be any Californian strawberries. I mean, it will be subject to every single pecuniary interest of every single member of council, and it will run itself into the ground and be an unmitigated disaster.
I can't imagine that. I mean, I can't even imagine that we do this pilot project or whatever he thought of, David.
Well, I mean, first of all, let's back up. Why did this idea and where did this idea come from? It came from small towns in America where they used to have a grocery store. Walmart comes in. They open up a Walmart. The Walmart drives the grocery store out of business. And then the folks at Walmart decide, store's not making enough money. We're going to shut it down. And then all the people living in that town don't have fresh access to fresh groceries anymore. They have to drive 2-3 hours to get groceries. So you have some municipalities that came in and said, we'll open up a grocery store. Last I checked, here in the city of Toronto, no one has to drive 2-3 hours to get to a grocery store. Now, you know, if you're in one part of the city and you really want, you know, a particular brand, I guess you will have, you know, if you're really super choosy, I guess you have to make a bit of a commute. But the problem that this was intended to solve doesn't exist here. How exactly Mamdani is going to make this work in New York City, if it's going to work, if it's going to be a big failure? Why do we even have to do this pilot until we see what comes out of there? I mean, if they figure out something super amazing and wonderful, okay. I mean, if it works, then sure. If it works, it works. But more than likely, they're trying to solve a problem in New York City that doesn't exist, which is that people, for the most part, have grocery stores in their area. Now, the criticism will be they have grocery stores that are selling food for very high prices. But unless you're subsidizing the food, how do they intend to get the prices down? So from my perspective, one, we don't have the issue in Toronto that we're trying to solve for here. And two, if they manage to make something work in New York City that's wonderful and amazing, okay, I guess we can look at it. But, you know, to believe that the city of Toronto is going to do this in an effective manner really is, you know, it's kind of crazy, right? And to Rob's point, if you let council dictate which products you can and cannot sell in a grocery store, this will be an endless waste of time because everyone will pick their favorite nonsense fight to have at council and their favorite culture war to wage, but now it'll be in the grocery aisle.
Such a dumb idea, Libby, I refuse to get exercised about it.
It literally just boggles the mind, though there are, and I'm thinking of Regent Park before the development. So they did have a lack of grocery stores. They had convenience stores that were expensive, but hey, I think we've already devoted too much time to this, and maybe that's what was behind the whole idea, because Anthony Peruzza doesn't get a lot of attention.
Well, he's getting some attention on this one, and unfortunately, it might stick to him. The idea that like Dollarama and competition is meeting the demand of markets, and Dollarama is growing in every corner of the city and across the country, and it is a great success because they have some low cost items, and people who are buying one or two items at a time can afford to make.
They have groceries. They're not fresh.
No, not fresh vegetables or fruit, but they have canned products.
Yeah.
And they have some of the pre-mixed food items, and they have some seasonings. And if you want to save a buck or two, I've used them. I've bought some things from there. And while I try to avoid the chocolate aisle and try to avoid the candy, the cheap candy and chips. But to David's point, you know, the market will kind of dictate what happens. And there are a lot of dare I say, like green grocers that open up. But like this business is very, very, you have to be very agile in this business. So the market that, you know, on Bloor Street and the Kingsway, you know, those folks go to the food terminal and I've seen it. They'll buy product that's maybe not great, but they'll pick through it. They'll buy it for a penny on the pound, pick through it, pick out the great stuff and rescue that food and sell it to us as fresh produce at a moderate price. There's no way in hell the bureaucrats at the city of Toronto are going to get up at 5 a.m. or 3 a.m. to go down to the food terminal and negotiate a better deal than that small green grocer who's looking for creative ways to deliver food to the community that they serve. That's just not going to happen. They're going to overpay for absolutely everything because it's the nature of government. The suppliers see you coming. They know that you're not sophisticated or incentivized to pay a lower price, and they take advantage. And it happens every time on almost every procurement by the City of Toronto.
Okay. Yes. That's all I can say to you, Rob, on that is yes. We only have a few minutes left. Anthony, I know you want to talk about this fire in Mission, BC.
There was a terrible fire at a retirement home, a Chartwell retirement home in Mission, BC. It was a three-story complex, had about 115 residents. The fantastic news is that no one died. And this is because all retirement residences, congregate living for seniors in Canada now have fire suppression system sprinklers. So sprinklers allow residents who can't run out the door to be aided and assisted to get out before the fire spreads, and often stopping the fire from spreading at all. In the case of the Mission fire, they didn't have sprinklers in the attic system, so the building eventually all burned to the ground. But they were able to get every resident out of the building safely, and there were no deaths. Compare that to 2014, the fire in the Quebec nursing home. It was a Ile Verte, Quebec, there were 34 residents that died, or 32 residents that died, and there were dozens others injured. And that was a building that was in the process of making an addition, and they had sprinklers on one side, but they didn't have sprinklers on the other, and all the residents on one side of the building died, and the others got out.
Just a point, this was a retirement home, and people in retirement homes are generally in better shape than people in nursing homes. Did that play in?
Well, I don't think necessarily, because that building's been around since 2013. So people tend to live there for a while, and you might move in when you're a spry 69-year-old, but you're staying there for a longer period of time. So that can lead to different levels of mobility. But the idea that right now there's 500,000 Canadians living in retirement care settings, so with retirement home or long-term care home. That number is going to only increase over the number of years. The amount of new builds have all been forced to build sprinklers in their systems. There was pushback when this was being advocated for by the fire chiefs across the country and by groups like CARP. The builders would say, oh, it's too expensive. We can't retrofit. The building's too old. We won't even bother building retirement homes if you make us do these fire suppression systems. But they were required to do so, and it has made all the difference in BC, and I think it's saving lives right across the country.
Okay. I'm going to wrap things up. We got a text on, guess what? The city-run groceries, and I think it says it all. And this is Steve. And Steve writes, the fact that the concept of city grocery stores is even being floated tells you everything you need to know about this council. Right on, Steve.
I think you hit it on the mark.
Okay.
Yep. We'll see you in the vegetable aisle, Steve.
On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you so much, David Valentin, Rob Davis, and Anthony Quinn. And we will talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Libby. Bye.
Okay, people, we're taking a break. Lots of news about the Strait of Hormuz. Iran is blocking shipping from going through there, blocking oil. We'll talk about this strategic area, what's going on there, the Americans bombed Karg Island, but not the oil refineries there. We will get the scoop on that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, there is no avoiding the Iran war's impact on the price and availability of oil. Iran's blockade of the Strait of Hormuz is choking off a significant amount of the world's crude supply, blocking Gulf countries from exporting their oil while allowing tankers picking up Iranian crude to pass freely and keeping its own oil flowing to China and other countries. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is calling on allies to band together to reopen the strait, and sources say that he is weighing a seizure of Iran's critical oil depot on Karg Island, a move that would require U.S. boots on the ground. So it's complicated, and helping to sort us out, I am now joined by Christian Luprecht, professor at the Royal Military College in Queen's University, and Pasha Madavi, an associate professor of political science at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Thank you both for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so let's start with you, Christian. So just explain why the strait is so critical and how the Iranians can have control of it.
Well, the strait is one of sort of a dozen global choke points, in particular, and it's particularly important for the movement of energy, oil and natural gas. Now, North America were less affected by that because much of the oil and natural gas that goes through the strait goes either to Asia and some of it goes to Europe. But there are consequences much more broadly because the high energy prices will drive up, for instance, cost of food. So it'll be a driver of considerable instability in parts in other parts of the world. And it has sort of a pro and con situation, I guess, consequence for China, because China procures a significant amount of its oil through the Strait of Hormuz. At the same time, China seems to be ambivalent about the regimes in the region as long as it can continue to procure oil. And we knew that it was always going to be threading the needle in terms of a conflict in that region, because, of course, in the 1980s, Iran had already resorted to measures that made travel through the strait much more difficult.
Pasha, your take?
Yeah, I'd very much agree with that, because this is, you know, not just one of the choke points. It's really the biggest choke point for oil and gas and oil products. And just to throw some numbers on there, many have already heard some of these, but about 20 million barrels per day of oil and petroleum products pass through typically the Strait of Hormuz, which is about 20% of world oil consumption. But interestingly, it is about 27% of worldwide transport of vessel crude, and a lot of the world's oil, about a quarter of it, gets around via pipeline. And so this is a bigger shock to those that are importing oil via shipping. As Christian mentioned, most of the oil that comes out of the Persian Gulf and through the Strait of Hormuz goes to Asia, China, India, Korea, Japan, and others. But make no mistake that oil is a global market. So we are affected anytime those that are unable to get crude oil, they're going to seek those resources elsewhere. So it puts a pinch on the rest of the market. It has not created the oil price doomsday scenario just yet. Oil prices are high, but the world does have existing spare capacity to cover some of that shortfall. And there are alternative ways out of the Persian Gulf. There are some pipelines that the Saudis maintain, for example, and the Emiratis maintain to try to circumvent the Strait of Hormuz, but they are much smaller than that 20 million barrels per day. So there is some capacity to get that oil out. So it's a very critical area, and really having the impacts that we are seeing right now in both energy markets and of course, beyond.
Christian, we heard a few days ago that the Iranians were planting mines in the strait. So I'm curious, if they're planting mines, how is it that they are allowed to let their own shipments go through and block others? I mean, doesn't a mine explode whoever's traveling over it?
Well, so Iran, the regime, has a whole host of asymmetric capabilities with which it can complicate matters in the strait. It's important to understand that at its narrowest passage, the channel is 2 miles wide. So effectively, if you sink two ships in the channel, you've effectively blocked the straits. Then there's small artillery and rocket fires. There's drone capabilities. And there's a host of mine capabilities, both sort of converted mines that are really artillery shells and so forth that you convert to a mine, as well as much more sophisticated mine technology, some of which you can actually target to certain types of ships, and you can remotely activate it and deactivate it. So it depends what capabilities Iran still has to lay those mines and to get those mines where they need to be. The problem with mines is they often don't quite stay where you lay them, so it tends to complicate matters significantly if you want to reopen the strait in itself. But I mean, Iran has prepared for this fight for 40 years. The regime has its deterrent strategies. Iran realizes that it is the smaller and weaker player in this fight. And so that the Strait of Hormuz is one of the asymmetric deterrence capabilities that it has, and that it can escalate or de-escalate in the strait depending on what signal it wants to send to its adversary.
Is the U.S. kind of hamstrung in this, Christian? And, you know, a lot of people say so far the big beneficiary of all of this is Russia, China.
Well, I'd actually say the two big beneficiaries, the biggest beneficiary is probably the United States, given that Trump's sort of overall drive, I think, to get his thumb on making the United States an energy superpower in light of what's going to be driving AI superconductors in the 21st century, and that the that this administration is tired of getting drawn into the Middle East, and it knows that some ability to control Iranian oil exports and ability to control the Strait of Hormuz is key to disentangling the United States from the Middle East. And the costs for the United States have been relatively low, at least this far, and have mainly been borne by other countries around the world. So in that sense, you can see why Trump, so far, I would say, it's actually looking much better for the United States than many commentators make it out to be.
I don't entirely follow that, Pasha. Do you agree?
Well, I will play up a bit more on the Russian side just because of another point that Christian raised earlier, which is about gas and liquefied natural gas, and especially for Asian importers. There are fewer places for them to turn to. Global crude oil markets may have that kind of spare capacity that I'd mentioned before, but that doesn't exist for gas. And so countries like Japan, North Korea, and China that are heavily reliant on LNG imports are severely constrained because they get a lot of that from Qatar. Qatar has not only shut off its LNG plant, but of course it can't even get the product through the Hormuz. And so they're turning to Russia and turning back to a place that the United States had said, no, nobody should be able to get this oil and gas very easily. But now it is pretty clear that is effectively back on the table. And that's true for Europe as well. The other winner, I think it's interesting to think about the United States as a winner. I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, although there are components within the United States that are benefiting. So oil producers within the United States are benefiting from these higher prices. But ironically, I think you are seeing now yet another turn towards alternative energy because of this, you know, another reminder of the volatility, the vicissitudes of oil and gas markets, and turning towards renewable energy as an energy security solution. And you're seeing that, you saw that happen after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, across the global south, countries that pivoted to solar and EV. You're seeing more of that attention now. And I say ironically, because Trump and this administration has been very anti-renewable. But it seems that one long-term consequence of this war is to add further support for renewable energy down the line. And that's really the best way to ensure the kinds of energy security that Secretary Chris Wright was talking about on Saturday, with them saying that the administration remains committed to putting all Americans and their energy security first. And it seems clear that the best way to do that is not through ramping up fossil fuels and continuing to rely on the system, but through alternative energy.
Okay. Christian, just explain to me a little more about how you see the Americans are benefiting from this. And do you think that realistically they might seize the oil depot on Kharg Island?
So one of the efforts by Trump is to effectively, I think, control much of the hydrocarbon capabilities sort of as much as he can in the world, and to maintain the U.S. dollar as the benchmark currency for energy and crude oil trades. And so controlling aspects of the Strait and controlling energy exports through the Strait and having his thumb on Iranian oil goes to significant lengths because, of course, China has been settling its trades with Iranian oil outside of the U.S. Outside of the U.S. benchmark. And China has also been a significant supporter of the Iranian regime. It's how the Iranian regime has rapidly rebuilt its missile capabilities. So it's also a way for Trump to curtail China. And part of, I think, the shift in perhaps moving the meeting between President Xi and President Trump is precisely that China is sort of between a rock and the hard place. China has lots of reserves, but it does put pressure on those reserves. You've seen China scale back some of the military sort of harassment that it runs of Taiwan, probably as a way to conserve sort of those reserves. But in the medium term, China, I think, isn't too fussed about who ultimately is in charge in Iran as long as they can continue to trade in that oil. So there's both primary and secondary sort of consequences and benefits that I think accrue to the United States. And this is why the President Trump is actually in this fight, because this is a much more about a bigger geopolitical and geostrategic shift in terms of American influence. But it'd be interesting to see what Pasha also thinks of that.
Okay, Pasha, giving you the last word on that.
Well, so I will say that it's interesting from the perspective of kind of whatever oil prize Iran may be. It's not a very big one. Even Kharg Island, Iran's production, averages around 3 million barrels per day, and it's actually come down significantly. So it's not a huge part of the story. The bigger part of the story here continues to be the inability for the Saudis, the Iraqis, the Emiratis, and the Kuwaitis of getting their oil out. So it's not clear why this would be beneficial to President Trump in terms of, securing Iranian supplies, although there is something to be said about securing that corridor. And we have seen the president do this in the Western Hemisphere, his idea around Venezuelan oil and securing these supplies. So there is some truth to that idea of geopolitical power and wielding that sword, both here in the Western Hemisphere and in the Persian Gulf. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops, if and whether the U.S. will stay and kind of navigate and secure the Strait of Hormuz in the long term or not.
Okay. We will be watching it closely. That's all I can say. Thank you so much, Christian Luprecht and Pasha Madavi. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. We are taking another break, and when we come back, well, you know something's up when governments try to, put in new laws, new moves very late before a weekend, and that's exactly what they did last Friday. And we will talk about that move when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we know something's up when a government introduces legislation or amends it late on a Friday before a weekend or a holiday. And if this piece of it goes through, we may never be able to find out what is up and what they are hiding. Business Minister Stephen Crawford announced that the Ford government will be, quote, modernizing Ontario's privacy protections and bringing the province's technology practices into the 21st century. Well, here's the thing. These amendments will exclude the records of the premier, cabinet ministers, parliamentary assistants, and their offices under the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act. So, all those things that we have found out about the Greenbelt, about certain expenses through Freedom of Information requests, well, they may not be happening in the future. So here are the numbers. Texts and long-distance phone calls can come through 866-740-4740. Local phone line is 416-360-0740. And now let's go to Jessica Smith-Cross, who is the editor-in-chief of The Trillium. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for talking about this. First of all, did this surprise you?
I wish I could say it did, but this was something I had specifically been worried about. And it, in fact, had talked about this issue of changes to the FOI laws, making them harder for us to get records from, with my colleagues shortly before the announcement was made on Friday.
Okay. And so what do you think brought this on?
You know, I can only speculate, but the government is facing a lot of contentious FOI battles right now. Journalists, those are the ones I'm most familiar with, but from like advocacy groups and opposition politicians as well, are seeking records that the province doesn't want to give up. So Global has a pretty high profile battle for the premier's cell phone records for a certain time, all the government related calls that he's made. We have several high-profile requests about the Skills Development Fund scandal and the decisions that the Ministry of Labor made to fund certain groups. with close connections to people in the government for labor funding. And there are other requests still ongoing, battles over records that have to do with the Greenbelt, and including one case that has gone to court. So it does seem like that all those requests have been a big part of this. I know this because when the government is making these changes, they're specifically making them retroactive to cover these ongoing battles, not just for any requests going forward.
Now, they say they're modernizing the laws, and, you know, maybe we do need to modernize this. Are they, in your opinion, just sneaking these things in and trying to mislead us about the real impetus for this? Or are there two separate things here that maybe should be separated?
Yeah, the major thing that people are upset about here, you can't call the modernization. It's changing a practice that has been in place in Ontario for over 30 years. It's not something that is done because we now have cell phones. The change here being that all these records that are produced by a minister's office, so that's like the political staff around a minister, not the civil servants, but like the minister's people, those are now going to be off limits to these FOI requests from journalists and activists and opposition politicians. That doesn't matter whether they're using a cell phone or a WhatsApp or a Google Drive. Those things are supposed to be available now, just as they were if they were using paper memos or emails or whatever.
Give us an idea how many of the things that we ultimately find out about come through this, and what would the options be if this thing goes through? And I'm assuming they have a majority, it'll go through.
Yeah, we use FOI requests in our reporting all the time. We have, you know, dozens ongoing over various different issues. Not all of them would be affected by this. Some have to do with ministers' offices and some don't. We do a kind of request for the schedules of ministers and the premier, because they don't proactively disclose who they're meeting with. And if we want to know what's on the premier's official schedule for the day, we have to use an FOI request, whereas other levels of government, other provinces just proactively disclose that sort of thing. So we rely on them all the time, and they found the sort of like the building blocks for a lot of our investigative work.
And so what do you think we'd be losing? What kind of things would they be, quote, getting away with if this goes through?
Even from the basic of what I'm doing on a given day, it's yet to be seen how they're going to handle issues like expenses. You've got groups like the Canadian Taxpayers Federations who keep a close eye on, you know, what ministers' offices are spending. That's the sort of thing that should be out in the open. And it's not clear yet how that issue is going to be handled. And we also get the sort of, you know, it could be a message between staffers in a minister's office that tells the truth about why they're doing a certain thing that maybe they didn't want to see disclosed. But I will also say that in some ways, before this change, we're not seeing a lot of that sort of thing. The government has been made a bit of a practice of not documenting things because they don't want it to be FOI'd in the future. So that leads to major decisions made without like documenting the reasons why. So presumably, should this go forward and be left unchallenged, it will be easier to speak in textual communications about the reasons why you're making a change, the political ramifications, whatever it is you want to discuss in a minister's office about a hot topic, without worrying that someone's going to find out later on what you actually think.
And is there any way to resist?
I don't know. You know, the government has broad powers to make laws, and it seems like they have the power to make this change. Whether or not it is within the bounds of the law to suddenly stop the requests that are ongoing, it doesn't seem fair to me, but I'm not a lawyer, and no one's taken them to court over it yet.
It seems like it's part of a general move, you know, that we see all over the world, all over North America, of governments to be less transparent, less open, more authoritarian. Do you see this as part of that?
Yeah, I think this is part of a trend. And it's something that drives me absolutely crazy as a journalist. If you are in government and you are spending great deals of a taxpayer's money, you deserve to give them an explanation. And we over and over again see decisions that are made without a full explanation of why they're being made. We're investigating the Skills Development Fund because the government has spent millions upon millions, billions of dollars even, giving this money out to groups without explaining why some were chosen over others, why some that had applications that the civil service thought weren't deserving, why they got money over groups that had a good application that the civil service at least thought was deserving of a lot of public funds. We're trying to use the FOI system to get the real reasons why these groups were chosen. Was it not just that they had a good lobbyist who was, you know, well connected with the government, or was somebody that somebody personally knows? Because that's what it looks like right now.
It's all very disconcerting. And, you know, you're talking about huge amounts of money from the public purse. But, you know, I'm reminded of that very old expense thing. And it's not necessarily mismanaging millions of dollars. It's the $16 orange juice.
Yeah, you could buy a lot of $16 oranges for some of the money I'm talking about right now. But you're right, the people, the public can latch on to the $16 orange juice pour revota for, you know, an example of this sort of thing that they can easily understand and identify with.
So is there a plan again to, this is coming up March 23rd when the House resumes. Is there a plan to try to deal with it, or maybe to move forward on a lot of these stories before the axe comes down?
I can only hope. We have so many requests out, and there are some that I'm expecting back that I am just hoping and praying at this point get done before this comes down. But it's really out of my hands. I can't make the civil servants work faster and get those records to me before the law has changed.
Yeah, I always thought that the government had a way they could slow walk all this stuff just by having fewer people work on these requests, that was certainly a lever.
Yeah, no, they do take longer than they're supposed to. They're backlogged. There are some where I can't get an answer to a question for months and months and months. Hello there, you have my request. I haven't heard anything. You're supposed to have this 30-day time limit. Hello, hello, into the void.
Into the void. Well, we certainly need that information, and we're very appreciative of all the time that you spend trying to get it. Thanks so much, Jessica Smith Cross.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, that is all the time we have for Fight Back for today. I'm Libby Znaimer. I'll be back here tomorrow, and we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.